Hi, I'm Hedgeye's founder, Keith McCullough. Thanks for listening to this Real Conversation. If you like what you hear, you will love our investing research. We bring transparency, accountability, and actionable investing ideas to investors big and small. I'll put our investing process and team up against anyone in the world. Please visit Hedgeye.com to subscribe and learn a better way to invest.
Please welcome to the stage Keith McCullough and Hugh Hendry for a Real Conversation.
He got his tissues.
I could become very cheerful.
Oh, Hugh, welcome. So Hugh has been under the weather, but he still made it to be here for, and thank you. This is my 100th Real Conversation. I get to have it with this beauty. All right. For those of you that didn't know, Hugh, son of a Scottish truck driver. So you got the Irish guy and the Scottish guy here. I think you're up 30% in 08. So he's got a lot of experience, on successful experience with market crashes that others don't. And I want to start with that. I think a lot of people have questions on when the shit hits the fan or if it's hitting the fan. So as you called it, our encounter has begun. Why don't you go with what you think?
It has hit the fan. It has hit the fan. But this is the toughest point in the execution of risk portfolios with the objective of realizing a profit, because more seasoned investors will recognize that when you've read the last, never read the last chapter. It spoils a good book. And when you know what's going to happen, it's kind of hard. I mean, you look at it today, they sell off treasuries, they're buying equities again, you know. And so, this for me, it feels redolent of the drama of 2008, and we've had Bear Stearns go. Yeah. And everyone's like, oh, okay, well, we've lanced the barrel. There's a solution. Listen to the Fed. We got this, guys, all right? And we have to be very conscious, not only of our determination, but clearly, being a judge with the beauty contest, you have to be very cognizant of how market participants and their reaction function. And we suffer from this blasted thing called causality. And I can't deny there is a very strong correlation between the Fed, the Bozo's balance sheet, and the direction and the magnitude of rise in risk assets. I don't know all the answers, but my prejudice is that is causality. I believe that the Federal Reserve is an incredible machine for propaganda, and it needs to perpetuate the notion of its omnipotence, even if that's not the case. And so for my mind, the production of these inert bank reserves is very much a very powerful mechanism that has achieved the purpose of everyone being in awe of the Federal Reserve. But at the same time, it coincided with profound changes in the global economy, which I date to about 1997, 98, and then shortly thereafter, WTO in 2001, and the rise of China, and a new form of foreign trade engagement, where you close your capital account, you coerce the private household sector under the tyranny of regressive taxation, under the tyranny of many kind of social structures, to save. There is nothing Chinese or Asian. I mean, I've been in these markets long enough. Before we had Asia, we had Latin America, I remember my first job out of university. I was an investment analyst and fund manager with Baillie Gifford in Edinburgh. Our largest overseas holding was Telmex. Yeah. And there was just something innate to the Mexican culture, work culture. They just worked harder. You know, we invent narratives. And we have this narrative now of Asian savings. It is very much determined by state planners. And it is very much to support their initiatives in foreign trade. And so we've reached a point where China prior to the previous financial crisis in 2007, China had accumulated each year a trade surplus of 20% of GDP. Now, to put that in perspective, China is now the size of Europe, $15 to $17 trillion. And America, America had a moment when it was China, or China's having a moment following the US, I think, better put. And I had to correct myself. There's nothing wrong with the persistency of the Chinese positive balance. The US turned positive with with all of its efforts to industrialize in the 19th century. And from 1900 to 1970, the US ran a persistent trade surplus with the rest of the world. And then we had two devastating wars during that period. And so peak US, the US ran a positive balance in the trade of manufacturers, which amounted to 6% of GDP. And so put that as your reference point to China hitting almost 20% of GDP. And even today, it's 14% of GDP, and it's rising again. Now, that money, what is that money? That money is over $7 trillion. And that money, so when transactions, when trade is settled, you're seeing the de-dollarization BS, you are free to settle in any currency that you wish. But when you as an exporter in Shanghai receive, an exporter in Sao Paulo with the wonderful Lula, who's a bit Lulu, but when you receive red cabbage currency, what do? Like, you buy dollar assets. So you've, to my mind, the surplus of the savings, which is in excess of $7 trillion and continuing to grow like an enormous snowball, is the size of, if not greater, than the Fed's phantom balance sheet. And it's not inert. It's not a bank reserve. It goes into the euro-dollar system. And the euro-dollar system, if I may remind you, is a private matrix-like network of banks around the world. And they create what I call non-sovereign dollars. They print dollar money outside the frontier and outside the jurisdiction and the regulation of the Federal Reserve. And that $7 trillion plus hits that system, and that system has infinite leverage. It's governed essentially by relationship between parties. That's why you have the asset price inflation that you have today. That's why you have the corrosion of this incredible American economy from one which was known for its entrepreneurial flair and discipline to one now when a bright high school graduate comes to me and he says, what should I do? And I have to say, you've got to be a rent seeker on Wall Street. So the Fed had its announcements this week, and it just reveals that it's a bit player in that wider drama. Interest rates, I believe, will have to go back to zero. We'll discuss that. But really, to push us forward, it's not the Fed that can resolve this. This is kind of Plaza Accord head of government. God forgive us, it will never happen. But my lament sitting in front of you today is the storm which is now onshore. The economic contraction that Stan Druckenmiller, the legend of macro, has proclaimed and has this great feeling is approaching is such a wasted opportunity. We're going to have another economic contraction based on the folly of the Federal Reserve. I would much rather we have this economic contraction because we're addressing everything that I've just discussed with our mercantilist friends. We could close the capital account. What do they say, flattery? Or we say copying is the greatest flattery. You say, you know what? We're learning. You got it right. You have a closed capital account. We really can't buy your assets. Seems to have worked out really well for you. We're going to copy. Okay? One means to doing that, you would impose a withholding tax on sovereign holdings. They are They're in custody with the New York Fed. We know where they are. You raise money. What do you do with the money? You eliminate the Social Security contributions that you as an employee pay. Make labor in this country cheaper so that it's not lost to offshore grounds. But even if you want to keep it open, recognize these guys are going to finance you come what may. Let's run, I know you're not going to like this, but let's run better deficits. Let's run bigger deficits, which are not deficits from the bailout of the banking sector, but they're deficits from sorting out healthcare. Like, people, there's so many adverts for drugs on daytime TV because the ordinary folk can't afford a doctor. Yeah, I thought this virus I've had for the last 10 days, I went to a clinic. Lucky me, I could afford that. Most people would just be blowing their nose. So sort out the education system. Bring down the tax on employing folk. The, whatever it is, what's it called? The silly inflation reduction thing, which is the green investments. You're going to read lots of bad things. It's a bloody great idea. Like, actually just pay government money to the private sector to make things in this country. Yeah? So there's lots of things we can do, but when you attempt to close the capital account, boom, it's a nail into the bubble of asset prices. Asset prices will deflate, and we would have the similar, if not more severe, economic contraction that we will now get because the banking sector has died, has expired. So I'm done.
That's a lot. And I want to get into, you know, because I do think that to have an appreciation for crashes and the ongoing nature of recessions and how they perpetuate crashes is something you've actually done successfully. And I do think you have to have some experience. You know, you need to, most people that do macro, like now, they're just tourists, right? On this, you know, nail to the bubble, like most people, most hedge fund managers will ask me, okay, well, we just got to ask the same question. You know, how fast does this end? Where does it end? Like, what is the sense of urgency based on what the Fed just said? Do you think that there's a direct link between what they just said, you know, at the most recent meeting to the next month or two of what you think is going to happen?
No.
Hi, I'm Keith McCullough, and I wanted to introduce you to my favorite product at HedgEye, the Macro Show. Why is it my favorite product? Well, it's my show. I do that every morning. If you want to get ready for the market day, you want to contextualize all the data, you want to make good decisions, then this is what you should be watching. It's a repeatable process that you can deliberately study, measuring and mapping time series to time series of data. So it's not going headline to headline and getting whipped around. It's actually being so much more dispassionate about it and making good decisions that are data driven. So we'd love to have you on our team. Come join us.
Tune in weekdays at 9 a.m. Eastern and on demand anytime. Go to hedgeye.com/research to subscribe.
I thought it was a very black day for another black day for the Federal Reserve. It's easy to sit on a platform like this and badmouth the Federal Reserve. But first and foremost, I think they're do-gooders. I think they are genuinely attempting to do good things, but I think they're hopelessly unqualified. You know, I saw that Biden has nominated a new vice for the chair. Does anyone know this guy? Has anyone checked his record? I mean, do we just lamely accept it? Is Jay Powell the greatest, or is he a redoubtable spirit in the world of economics? Is he an economic philosopher? Does he get things? That's not to put him down. Not everyone is to be charged with that responsibility. But that's not the folk that we choose. And then you have the irony that it's a Politburo. Here we are. This is the greatest, this is the asset capitalist kingdom. And we have a market-based solution to the setting of interest rates. It's called the markets. We get a market price every day. And that market price is made up of literally thousands upon thousands of people with different agendas. Some people are seeking speculative gains, but a lot of people, it's kind of fear that they have to hedge expectations of where we will be in the future. And so the interest rate from what was the euro, you know, the, we now call it SOFR or something, so far ridiculous. but it's like a restaurant. You know, when I'm in a foreign town and I'm hungry and I walk past an empty restaurant, I'm like, maybe I'm not that hungry. If I walk past a busy restaurant, I'm like, hey. And you know what? Normally, the busy restaurant kind of, it's satisfying, right? We have that, and yet we choose either the Vatican or the Moscow system of having like a group of wise people. It's preposterous. Okay, so anyway, we've got a problem with banking. Would you like that I mention that? So probably SVB was the conclusion of the banking sector as we've come to understand it. And for everyone that wants to badmouth their management, that wants to badmouth the management of smaller regional banks, shame on you. Like, there's incompetence in all walks of life. Incompetence does not begin to describe or define what's just happened, I believe. But you know, the advent of telephone digital banking has just made deposits too flighty. Yeah. You can't support illiquid and largely more longer-term loans, commercial loans, loans to the household sector, the industrial sector. You can't support that with flighty capital. So banks, I don't know where they go next. The Fed, however, I think this is perhaps a folly on the magnitude of 1930, and therefore the repercussions could be as dramatic. But the total U.S. banking sector has $23 trillion in assets. That's one times GDP. Their loans will be $17, $18 trillion, and the balance will be government securities agency paper. There was a Fed paper in March that estimated that the mark-to-market loss on the total portfolio was $2.3 trillion. And that loss effectively would tell you that the entire banking sector has negative equity. The folly of the Federal Reserve is that every hiking cycle has to be done in a dramatically conservative. There's an oxymoron. Let's be dramatically conservative. It has to be steady. If you think of Greenspan and Bernanke, if you think of the rise in rates after the Nasdaq bubble, it was, we're going to raise 25 basis points, and 2 months later they raised 25 basis points. We're going to raise 25 basis points. 2 months later they raised 25. You know, and it occurred over an expanse of time of three approaching 4 years. Why? Because the asset book for banks doesn't adjust. It takes like 18 months to adjust. If the banks were to match the Fed step by step, the net interest margin would be crushed. They would be unprofitable. An unprofitable bank is not a risk-seeking bank. A banking community that's not risk-seeking is not providing credit. An economy that doesn't have the expansion of credit is an economy which is contracting. That was all thrown out of the window. It is just a fact that the rapidity and the magnitude of the rate hikes in this cycle are second to none. On top of the technology that created the incentive to use the technology and to expose that the banking sector is over. And so the black day of the Fed, what did they do? They raised interest rates again. They're like, oh, we've not had enough capital flight. We've not had enough deposit flight. Hey, guys, I know you're getting 10 basis points on CDs. We at the Fed, we're now giving you 525. Good deal. I mean, hello, is anyone in the building? So I told you, trillions of dollars of unmarked losses, marked and unmarked losses, a combination. Some of that 2.3 trillion will have been the books with the trading books which are not held to maturity. P&L would have come, marks would have come through their P&L. But when you go back to the bankruptcy of the U.S. banking sector in the 1930s, the Federal Reserve Act of 1934, you had the confiscation of gold, which kind of seems incredible. so far away 90 years later looking back, and yet we begin to see that it's more and more credible. If I was looking at that situation, if I was in the high powers, the high corridor powers in Washington, I'd have to be saying, system's dead, banks are dead, Fed, stop raising rates, you know, stop please, right? But seriously, we'd have to consider, you'd have to call it temporary, but you'd have to think of a lock. You'd actually have to prohibit U.S. citizens from taking money out of the banking sector in order for Washington to work a reset to try and determine a new banking model. And so you're a business, and you'd have to apply to have a withdrawal from your accounts for your business, etc. All of this, I mean, there are tales of dentists needing gold for fillings. You'd have to make a submission to the Federal Reserve in 1934, and they go, okay, you know. Is that going to happen? I don't know. Is the probability of that happening, has it gone from like zero to something like something where we actually have to discuss that? I think that's where we are today. So the FOMC meetings, I think, are by and large irrelevant now. Mm-hmm. They have busted the banking sector. We have deflationary money. Over the course of sorting out market, kind of the market narrative, asset prices will contract. And then remember, we're just talking about onshore sovereign dollar creation. We're talking about dollar printing from private US resident banks from the extension of loans. I want to say that the offshore market, this euro dollar market, is bigger still than the domestic. And that market's contracting. And we'll discuss that later, because the greatest evidence of that contraction can be seen in the dollar-yen exchange rate. Teaser.
How do you get from here to the rate cut? Do credit and equity markets have to go through some version of, I think you called it hell this morning, and quickly?
Well, the hell is a personal hell. The hell is knowing the conclusion, but seeing the twists and the turns. And again, to all want to be Stan Druckenmiller's, we all want to be Stan. The genius is in navigating. Mm-hmm. Navigating. Remember, June 2008, we had oil almost approaching $150. We had the ECB. I love the ECB. ECB raised interest rates. There is an amazing academic professor of labor economics, a Brit, but with a tenure in the US. And something happened. He's been banned from Twitter. He's called Professor Danny Blanchflower, an incredible soul. And Danny was lifted actually by Gordon Brown, who was the Prime Minister of the UK at the time, and Gordon kind of said, I want this guy on the FOMC, if you will, the British one. And Danny is he's the only good guy that ever got into one of those committees. If you look at the deliberations in August of 2008, there were two dissents to the decision to keep rates on hold at 5.5%. August 2008. And one of the dissents was, we should be raising rates. That was not Danny. Danny, for a year, has said, you guys are loopy, right? We're going down. This Phillips curve that you conceive of, there is no statistical relationship. It's an invented reality. And we've had we're having bankruptcies in the financial sector. Money is deflationary. We're going to zero. And they said, you're crazy. That's Danny.
How do you go, and I don't know what Druck said on this.
Oh, I do.
But he's bearish on the dollar for the first time in a while, right? And that a lot of people talk about that. Last time we went into the debt ceiling debate in 2011, of course, Bernanke devalued the dollar to a 40-year low. That's when gold hit its last all-time high, or at least cyclical high. where are you at on dollar yen? Like, where were you going to go on that? I don't know if Druckenmiller made any comments on what pair that he'd be long.
Yeah. Bernanke didn't devalue the dollar. What are you talking about? The last time gold hit its high was, what, 2011?
Yeah.
And the dollar index since the introduction of quantitative easing. So again, people, you've been sold a lie. So what is quantitative easing? We're printing dollars, trillions of dollars. We're making dollars plentiful. Those plentiful dollars today, 14, 15 years later, are worth more versus other currencies than they were. There hasn't been a devaluation, like a dollar devaluation maybe versus the price of other assets, but in the fiat world, the dollar has been the stronger. Currencies are not a high priority source for risk capital. I'm going to publish Stan's video, the interview he did with the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund. But it's like a kind of guerrilla thing. So Stan says something, and then I kind of say something, and the like. And I'm going to publish the first chapter today on Twitter. Stan talks about the permanent portfolio, diversification of buckets. And traditionally, you think of a permanent portfolio, think of it as compass points, and therefore you get four quadrants: S&P, treasuries, alternatives. Alternative is a big bucket. Yeah, it's gold, precious, palladium, plats, Bitcoin, property, index linked. Yeah, I mean, all together, well, including property, is big actually, maybe $100 trillion. And then you have cash. So S&P, treasuries, alternatives, cash. And cash could be pairs.
Yep.
Or it just could be, you know, the cash yield just now is high versus the 40-year data set. And you should think about that. You know, I pinned a permanent portfolio of my persuasion on Twitter. And it's a holding pattern. It's like, if you want to be invested, this is something where you can kind of look at it in 6 months' time. It's a slow evolving thing, which we'll reveal. But in terms of making allocations to quadrants, the quadrant with cash, I wouldn't be rushing to be exposed to risk, because what is a currency? You know, what is the value of a currency? You know, this is why I know a lot of you are going to be enamored with gold. I like gold because it's Dadaism. Gold's damn stupid. Uh-huh. Forgive me, it's damn stupid. And gold gets lit up, I believe, as a protest. It's like when you're just up to here with the morons running the system, you give them the finger and you buy gold. gold is typically, in the real world, not in the matrix, your allocation would be no more than 10%. So I'm talking, and I'm making comparison with currencies and why it's not a big, it's not where I go to take risk. And the reason is, what is the value of gold? And I know every single one of you will have an opinion, but it'll be narrative based, and you won't actually be able to reduce it to a concrete valuation. You know, there is a valuation for property, and it may be a changing valuation, but there are metrics, and there are metrics for fixed income, there are metrics for equity. There isn't that discipline in the gold market. There isn't that discipline in currencies. They just move. They're thought systems. Anyway, so Stan is broken my heart, because I don't see what he's proclaiming in the dollar. You're within a channel established since 2009. Mm-hmm. It's still an uptrend. It could come lower. I think around about 100, if anything. If you put a gun to my head, I want to buy it. But who cares? Dollar yen. Dollar yen is a manifestation, I think, in his fixed income book. Mm. And he's doing the Widowmaker trade, which again is like, Dan, sorry. Stan, call me. Stan said he only has contentious, angry, gnarly people that work for him. I'm yours, Stan.
I was going to tell you a story, but I don't think. Just my mic's on, yeah. So if you look at it, I look at charts. If you look at a 40-year price chart of dollar yen, you're like, merde, something's gone down. I mean, the break, the price disruption that we've seen in the last 18 months really has, it looks as if it is capable of profoundly turning that chart upside down.
Did you just say merde?
Merde,
like,
yeah.
Like shit?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I thought you said.
I was going to say fuck, but I thought. In French, you can say, oh la vache, oh the cow, which is very inoffensive, but I recall I had a very super large French-speaking sovereign kind of pension fund client, and I was presenting in public on their behalf, and I said, oh la vache, and I was reprimanded. Everyone went, ooh.
French swears are awesome.
Like, yeah.
Mozi d'enfant chien, you say something like that. You guys know what
that means? Tu es un gros connard. Anyway.
So you looked at the 40-year chart of this thing.
40-year chart of the...
Would you always look at 40-year?
I want as much... I'm greedy.
As much as you can get.
I'm greedy for data, and I like slower evolutions. I like 20 and 40 months. I think I'm going to do a live Twitter thing next week. I've got a kind of... I do chart porn. I plug in like an index... And it brings up each chart, and it does it on these slow-moving metrics, all the data, awesome. And we'll just have it go through. I listen to music, and then sometimes I see a pattern, I'm like, and I lit up, and we'll talk about it. So I might do that next week. But dollar yen looks as if we kind of could, like, if it continues, it goes to 200. And if it goes to 200, it goes to 300.
Mm-hmm.
And so you kind of, it's a bit... like Snyder, Jesus, Jeff Snyder, and his deliberations with the yield curve. When you look at the magnitude of the inversion, it implies that the Fed is going to cut rates a lot. And most people just stop there. And what Jeff does very well is said, well, actually, what would cause the Fed to cut a lot?
Definitely.
And I think that's the next... step. And so it's kind of like, well, why would the dollar yen trade 200? And so everyone said, well, yeah, because the Bank of Japan are lunatics, and you know, look, you know, the JGB is the wrong price. I mean, Japan, and again, Japan is on the 27th iteration of quantitative easing. Like, you should not have iterations in policy. When you get to 2, 3, it's like, one didn't work, two didn't work, why will three work? And then you end up at 27. But Japan has had a depression. And again, question to everyone, why does the financial press no longer use the word depression? The conceit and the arrogance of modernity, we don't suffer depressions. You know, hello Tokyo. I've got no great kind of issue with, it's not at the top of my list of worries in terms of the pricing of the JGB market. But in terms of answering why would dollar yen trade 200 and keeping it within this story of quantitative easing. So they started it before everyone else. Their quantities are preposterously high. It's inert. You know, I walked to shitty Starbucks and bought a shitty Starbucks coffee. I offered them bank reserves and they refused. Yeah. But what if you could use those bank reserves as collateral? And what if you could go to the euro dollar market, the repo market? Repo market is there's a counterparty bank, and each day you present yourself and you say, I've got collateral. I've got, you know, sometimes I've got, you know, $100 million of S&P stocks. What would you give me? You know, if you hold them, how many dollars or dollar bills would you give me back? And if it's a conversation hedge fund with their drug dealer, did I say drug dealer? Your prime broker. They'll give you $100 million. In tougher times, it's more they don't want equities. They don't want property loans out of China. They don't want, et cetera. They want treasury bills. So what if So all these money center banks are just swimming in zero yielding financial government paper. And what if they went to the repo market and they got dollars back that the market accepted? I think that's what's happened. So they established the short position. They're short the dollar because every 24 hours, their counterparty may call you back in and you've got to kind of repay the dollars. And what if they took those dollar treasury bills and used it and lent it into mainland China? Every big industrial company in Japan is the biggest investors mainland in China, the Japanese. So it's natural their banks would follow them. And there's the old adage about German banking. There are societies where it's very, very difficult to control costs. They don't have the kind of razor's edge, perhaps, that we pursue I'm an interloper in the US. And so the easiest way to control your cost-income ratio as a bank is to grow your top line as opposed to contracting your costs. And so every bubble, every financial bubble, probably since tulips, you've always had Z German banks extending a lot of money there. Deutsche was enormous in 2006, 2007. The majority of the Fed bailout went to foreign banks, not to domestic banks.
Hi, Robert McGrory here, Director of Subscriber Development at HedgEye. Join our entire research analyst team live before the market opens for deep dive investing analysis, our favorite stock ideas, and our risk manager-in-chief, Keith McCullough's macro overlay. Our team of 40-plus equity analysts discuss key market developments, trends, and our high-conviction long and short investing ideas. You will not get this granular level of insight anywhere else. A video replay, audio version, and analyst summary notes from the call are available shortly after each live show to ensure you don't miss anything.
Go to hedgeye.com/research to subscribe.
And tune in live to the call weekdays at 7:45 a.m. Eastern. Enjoy the rest of this episode.
So it's natural that you would find a German or a Japanese bank in the hot areas, and China's been the hottest area for the last 25 years. And so what if the Eurodollar system, they had actually monetized and their banking reserves via the Eurodollar system and then taken a short position against the dollar and then taken term and credit risk into mainland China. And actually that kind of begins to tally up. If you look at all of that, if you look at the dollar yen through that prism and you look at the emergence of the ridiculous, the peak in Chinese property, $60 trillion, four times GDP. I've heard $60 trillion may be an underestimate, but, profoundly insane. And then you saw the bankruptcy emerge in the developers, and you saw kind of credit spreads widen, and you can just see the tap on the shoulder to the Japanese banks. I'm pulling you back. And as you get pulled back, what are you doing? You're buying dollars. So what if that's just the tip of the iceberg and they've lent too much and then there's going to be a lot more? That's something which could take us to 200. But that's not a widowmaker trade.
No.
And that's something that would push the dollar higher.
Yeah, I agree with you. At least my signals do. I get asked a lot about Druckenmiller because you and I actually disagree with them on that. So that's a very articulate way to go to a place that I've never gone before. But it's how do you tie that? If that were to happen, wouldn't Buffett just get paid in size? Like, he's buying the crap out of Japanese equities at below book and looking for the government of Japan to essentially mark equities, anything that's below book value, mark them at one times book. So the guy's not a young guy anymore. He wouldn't go there unless he was serious. But if you gave me 200 yen, why wouldn't every American go buy a spot in Tokyo? Their dollars.
Because you would fear it's going to 300, and so you would desist until. If it goes to 200, 300, it is the long promised or feared kind of form of aggressive inflation. Again, it would be a journey.
Yeah.
You would perhaps avoid the initial.
Yep.
Buffett. I launched one of these special purpose vehicles. I think it's a cleaner version. I would just like to say, anyone that's listening, if you've paid $1 million or more into a special purpose vehicle, which is offering you 50 to 100 times return payout on the Hong Kong dollar peg breaking, you've been sold a puppy. You've just spent a couple million dollars on a lottery ticket. Unless that is the Federal Reserve persists. If the Fed goes to 10%, yeah. If the Fed goes to 10%, everything withers, everything dies. But I had a special purpose vehicle, and I thought 2012 was 2023. I'd seen the future. I'd seen it too early. The curse of seeing it too early. And I had bought a lowly price volatility via corporate default swaps of Japanese companies. So we're back to Buffett. And I was actually short the credit. I was buying protection on the names that Warren, the trading companies. When I looked at the trading companies, these were rightly the most lowly rated enterprises in Japan, a record of no noble record in terms of shareholder expansion. Opaque, profoundly leveraged. I think his bet is the profound leverage in higher commodity prices he's doubled his money, if not more. Commodity prices, I think, where we are, the volatility that's emerging versus the leverage of those entities, I'd still be cautious. All of the arguments I had in 2012, I'm a broken record, but they seem relevant today. Anyway, tired of myself.
Good. I'm trying to think that one through. Japan, we have a lot of clients that obviously don't own Japanese equities getting asked more frequently about it, so that's an interesting question. If you guys have questions, by the way, get up and then I'll just call on you next. We have about 20 minutes left, and at the 15-minute mark, I wanted to make sure that you had your questions. What do you think is the... what do you think is the most misunderstood part of market flow right now? You take that from a global macro market perspective or equity market, whatever you want.
I'm not a flow guy. You know, hedge funds are always looking for the edge, and so you always want all these brokers. Yeah, I used to get. Well, I never got any calls, but I didn't have a telephone, but occasionally someone would get through and like, yeah, no, like we want to give you the edge, we're going to give you the juice, you know, we're going to tell you our best ideas before everyone else. And I was like, look, you know, I'm not interested. I don't want to be your first call, I don't want to be your last call, I just don't want you to call.
Yeah.
And I say that, sounds kind of arrogant, it's, I want to be the architect of my own success, and I very much want to own my own failures.
That's good.
And I've seen too many participants blame it on someone else, blame it on the other guy, blame it on the Fed. You know, I've seen the future that begins here. In terms of misunderstanding, the greatest misunderstanding, he pompously says, is inflation, the sources of inflation, quantitative easing, and our failure to recognize just how radically different the macro economy is from what it was prior to 25 years ago. So economics is meant to be the pursuit and the investigation and the observation of a system that can move into disequilibrium, disharmony, and how it finds itself back to the center. Which is kind of cool, you know, it's like a journey. And we've adopted a system where we're just stuck, and the system doesn't have the ability to right itself. So the parallel which seems closest, I mean, we talked about 1930, we talked about the 34 Federal Reserve Act, and we're gonna go back a little bit earlier. We talked about First World War, U.S., peak U.S. Trade surplus to the rest of the world was 6% of GDP. U.S. just rocked, yeah? And so we had an economic system whereby with those surpluses, you would receive gold. You'd either ship it or it'd be a ledger movement. And the idea was that the gold is high-powered money.
It was the gold standard. The gold would go into the vaults of the private sector. It would represent a liability. You have to match liabilities with assets. So the Treasury would be increasing your liabilities, and you as a private sector bank would have to take on assets, which is to say you would lend money. And starting around, I think, 27, Benjamin Strong, the New York Fed, who was running it on behalf of the Fed, said, the economy's booming. We just can't inject more high-powered money. You're crazy. And so they sterilized it. They didn't inject those liabilities into the banking sector. And there's an argument for that, but it broke the system of returning to equilibrium. Mm-hmm. Entropy and the type of thing, and it made the system very, very fragile. And ultimately it broke. It broke 3-4 years later. And so when we look at the world today, the China with 14% surplus to the rest of the world, in economics, what's meant to happen is the renminbi, the yuan, the Chinese currency, which presently you need 7 red cabbage to buy a US dollar. 30 years ago, you needed 8. So you've moved something like 12%. The Chinese population have become 12% more, less poor, if you will, versus the US. Don't you think it should have been more? Don't you think they should have become much wealthier? Which is to say, don't you think their currency should be trading at 4? You only need 4 red cabbage to buy a dollar. Of course, it can't trade there because they've closed the capital account. You're not allowed to withdraw money. You're not allowed to put money in. That's Benjamin Strong with not allowing the gold to go into the system. Mm-hmm. So we're stuck. So that's the money creation. That's the source of the money creation. And here we are. I said the banking model largely is defunct, needing change. I've just asked the question. Maybe, an insurance guarantee, the Treasury insuring deposits greater than 250,000, it won't stop people taking money out because the Fed's gone to 6% and the bank's still stuck down way behind. So what was I going to say there? I had a really good headline. I had a really powerful finish on that. So the powerful finish is, in terms of asset allocation, the money tap, so no US elected official is going to stand up and say, we're going to close the capital account. It's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. Okay. Which means the money will keep flowing, which means when you come to the 4 quadrants of the compass points, you buy the most reviled asset class within each quadrant. Because that flow, you asked me about flow, that flow of money will turn mean reversion into a profit opportunity. So today, the most reviled asset class is 30-year treasuries because of the perception of the inflation. But because of that, the price is halved. It's 3 standard deviations below its 40-year price theta. That means if you do a bell curve with the distribution, you're on this left side where the curve, where there's just not much, it never really trades there. So that's kind of interesting. I think the money flow will take it higher. If that goes higher, I suspect you will see a 20% plus downdraft in equities. If the S&P falls 20-25% from here, I'd start buying it. Mm-hmm. My greatest regret ever is I didn't buy the S&P in March 2009. I swore I'd never let that happen again. If you go to the next quadrant, gold has a lot of logic here. Gold can perform well here, but it could be volatile. It could be sold off as if there was a reach for liquidity, desire for liquidity. It's not reviled. Bitcoin is kind of reviled just now. I like I said yesterday on TV, I don't have the bug. I got the bug for regression. We don't have enough price data. That's the biggest issue. It's just it's a kid versus the grown-up of gold. But it's fallen from, let's say, 70,000 to 25,000. It might go to 10, but it might go to 100. 25 to 10, 25 to 100, I'll take those odds. And then you've got cash. So
stand in the industry said, there's going to be amazing micro opportunities. And just think of the quarters and think of mean reversion, because that's how he thinks, I think.
How about the, like, instead of a mean reversion, which is what we've essentially had in equities, you're down 15 on S&P, you're down 25 on NASDAQ, you're down 30 on Russell from the cycle high. That's been like a, what I call just kind of like an orderly mean reversion from a cycle high. What about the concept of just having the heart attack, the entropy to the, you know, the energy to entropy moment without having the normal Fed put? Why couldn't the S&P be down 20% today?
It could be.
Do you think that we're going to have a heart attack moment in equity markets, or they're just going to keep bleeding?
All of us underwrite that risk. That's why I'm not comfortable owning. That's the principal reason why, for all the logic in favor of the crazy asset called gold, I feel uncomfortable, because it would be sold off in that environment.
Yep.
Okay, Bitcoin would be sold off.
Because that's where you'd get liquidity.
That's what it's held. It's, you know, it's held there. The mean reversion in S&P, I'm careful with my words. I'm saying 30, 40 years of price data.
Yeah.
Okay? If you do the S&P and its sell-off, or NASDAQ and its sell-off, there's a hell of a lot of space. Yeah. This isn't rare. Where we are is not particular. Yeah. March 2009 was, you were right on the frontier of zero in terms of this rarely happens. Where we are is neither here, neither there.
Well, what do you think about AI, though, man?
I mean, let's just bring it, parcel it into our world. I think AI is, let's use the analogy with the evolution of the motor car. I'm going to make these numbers up. 40% of the input for agriculture were horses, and it'd gone. It went to zero. And there's an analogy there. You know, there's a huge amount of well-paid service sector and other located positions which are going to be taken out. Marxists are going to tell you it's the end of the system. Where can we take? Let's riff with this, actually. So I said to you, we've outlawed this notion of depression. Thankfully, in 200 years, I think we've had four depressions. 1820 to 18, end of the 1830s. 1870, 75 into the 90s, 1890s. The 1930s, and today, four. And each time it flares up this permanent plateau, and so the Marxists have got to come in, and we've just got to distribute income, redistribute income. And human ingenuity goes, no, we're going higher, baby. We've got a productivity thing which is going to make all of us richer. Some of you, you know, really rich. And AI, I think, is that. I think AI probably is how we bust out of this depression.
Yeah.
AI will it will boost capital, the value of capital stock, and I would say, again, how can we riff this? I would say, sorry, if we were, which I would recommend, closing or partially putting kind of grit in the capital account with a withholding tax, I said to you that I would eliminate the Social Security contribution for employees. And if I had any more money, or maybe I'd scrap some other things, because really what I want, the S&P, I think, is going to fall a lot. We're going to be talking about it being 2-3 standard deviations below its 40-year price average. And we know what's going to happen. The Feds are going to buy it in some manner. Now, what if we actually created a U.S. sovereign wealth fund for the disenfranchised? What if we set it up today and we said, look, some point, the market's so much bigger, right? We can't live in a... You said, why did they just gaps down? We can't underwrite a digital market where it goes to zero. We can't underwrite that. So we will have to support asset prices on behalf of everyone. The disenfranchised and the franchised. The number one, the root cause of the, one of the root causes of the political problem in America today is the disenfranchised. Set up a fund which is means tested.
You only get to participate in it because you don't own property, you don't have stocks, you got nothing. But you get to participate in a wealth fund, and when the feds come in and they bail the system, they're going to buy it at the low prices, and you're going to have an asset, and you're going to become franchised, and you're going to become a participant in the prosperity that AI and other things will produce. Like, let's wake up, people. Let's get smart, people. You know, we're going to have Biden and Trump jostling to be the next president again. You guys can do better.
Hi, Robert McGrory here, Director of Subscriber Development at HedgeEye. Hope you're enjoying our podcast. Start generating alpha with our suite of Sector Pro investing research products. Dive deep into retail, industrials, technology, and everything in between with exclusive access to the sharpest analysts and actionable ideas on Wall Street.
Go to hedgeye.com/research to subscribe.
Enjoy the rest of this episode.
Did I get that correctly, that the people are now the horses?
Some of them are. Well, I mean, a lot of doctors are.
Yeah.
You know, lawyers. I mean, you know, a lot of high paying. And initially, again, it's going to fill us with fear, the disruption.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking about all the other things. I mean, I use darknet. I don't. If every day you're telling a computer everything about yourself, you've been doing that for the last, 20 or 25 years. Yeah. Everything, all your secrets, everything. I don't give it anything. I don't get any pop-up ads.
This is maybe why the chart that I was showing earlier, I showed the 83% correlation between U.S. credit default swaps and NVIDIA, may be correct.
There's nothing correct in a U.S.
No, it's like if you're going into a depression and there's only NVIDIA left.
Yeah, you know the
AI equals depression, basically, on what you're saying. And that's what CDS does when you go when it goes up like that. It's predicting not a recession, it's predicting a depression.
No, well, to correct any misunderstanding, I suggested that the productivity forces of AI could be such in terms of their knock-on effect on profitability and therefore engendering more risk-seeking activity, which engenders credit, and this is how the economy works. This could be the escape velocity that we're missing, and this could take us out of the fourth depression, and it could, again, give the finger to the Marxists.
That's what Marxists. Who do you think's the worst Marxist, or the best, if you're going to be a Marxist?
I don't like the word best, but you know the most prominent, of course, is China. You've got a region the size of Europe, and they're Marxist.
Anyone have a final question? We have 2 minutes. Anyone by chance?
Can't believe it's not.
If you were to ask yourself the last question, what would you ask yourself?
There you go.
Oh no, we got one. Go for it. Can you use the mic? Yeah, thanks. It's like The Price is Right. You got to run all the way over there.
Gentlemen, this has been a fantastic conversation. What I'd like to know is where's the alpha trade?
Where's the alpha trade?
Yeah, the big one. The big obvious alpha trade that hews long or short.
Yeah, I mean, like, I don't think you're listening.
Oh, I am listening.
Yeah, it
has to come out somewhere.
This is like being on CNBC or Bloomberg, where you're trying to have a highfalutin conversation about economies and philosophy, and they go, yeah, but tell us the trade. I'm like, shut up. you know. Well, it's gonna come out in that we have. There are times when there's a fictitional element to the value of securities, of all risk assets, which is to say they become too inflated, and they have to compress. And as they compress, the destruction of collateral it contracts credit. It makes the economy weaker. You know, the principal alpha, the king who will reign over us in terms of markets will be the person who doesn't lose money. You know, it's that whole adage, you want to double your dollars? Half it in two, you know. and why I hesitate to answer that question is, I mean, okay, I'm going to give you an answer. It's the twos ten spread. I think there's inevitability that the system will have to revert to zero or negative real rates. I'm not saying that there's anything noble about that. It's not a value judgment. I'm just saying when debt's four times GDP, you got to be at zero. It doesn't function. That's what we're discovering. And Stan mentions this, you've got the 2 year, and the 2 year's going to track kind of pretty much pound for pound Fed cuts. The 10 year, and Stan's like, I kind of want to buy the 10 year. And I was like, what's the price today? It's got a three handle or something, the yield. And then I know that these bozos are going to panic, and they're going to print money. Do I really want to own the 10? So what that means is that the 10 year is not near money. And so the Fed might go to zero, but the yield might be a little bit sticky. Might just collapse, but it might be sticky. The stickiness is what you saw in 2008. I owned $1 million per basis point change in that spread. The spread moved 200 plus basis points. And if you look at that spread today, and again, look at 50 years of data, it's on its ass. Just turning. So that's your alpha trade. I hesitated or procrastinated because all the other trades are largely of a kind of short nature. And they entertain the prospect of infinite losses if you're wrong. For, you know, it's like I've got a defined gain, which is 100%, but undefined losses. That's not alpha, and that's why I procrastinated perhaps and ridiculed your question. Forgive me.
It's too bad we can't have time for more questions, but see that clock there? I just ran out of time. But Hugh, from the son of a firefighter, an Irish guy, son of a Scottish trucker, thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Don't forget to check out Hedgeye.com to get more actionable investing insights from our team of more than 40 research analysts. And check us out on Twitter at our handle, @Hedgeye. This presentation is informational only. None of the information contained herein constitutes an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any security or investment vehicle, nor does it constitute investment recommendation or legal, tax, accounting, or investment advice by Hedgeye or any of its employees, officers, agents, or guests. This information is presented without regard for individual investment preferences or risk parameters and is general, non-tailored, non-specific information. This content is based on information from sources believed to be reliable. Hedgeye is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions of information. The opinions and conclusions contained in this report are those of the individual expressing those opinions and conclusions and are intended solely for the use of Hedgeye subscribers and the authorized recipients of the content. All investments entail a certain degree of risk, and financial instrument prices can fluctuate based on several factors, including those not considered in the preparation of the content. Consult your financial professional before investing. The information contained herein is protected by United States and foreign copyright laws and is intended solely for the use of its authorized recipient. Access must be provided directly by Hedgeye. Redistribution or republication is strictly prohibited. For more detail, please refer to the terms of service at hedgeye.com/terms of service.